Okay. So, an eclectic collection of readings for this week, but I hope you found them as fun as I did. I have about an hour's worth of things that I want to say about the television talk shows and medical documentaries, and then we'll spend the last hour doing more discussion based about the other two pieces. FGCS and the autism bodies. And I hopefully I'll have the papers back by next week. It's my plan for the weekend. So if you haven't turned it in, just send it along. All right. So for me, while there are many, many themes, there's three that bubble to the top. And that's why I like the diversity of these pieces and the way they, at least two or three of them, tackle the same subject from a slightly different orientation. But throughout them all, we can see this reevaluation over time of this concept of what is normal, what is abnormal. And as it's being reevaluated, the concept of normal narrows considerably. And that's one of the key factors that plays a part in how we understand all these different extraordinary bodies that we're seeing. How we are looking at them, I think it's important to pay attention to the importance of the fact that these are publicly visible bodies. We've talked at the beginning of the semester about how this is the century of the image. This is our visual century. So Ed Kleinman has talked about not only are we more highly visually mediated than we've ever been before, we are also more highly medicalized than we've ever been before. So how this technologically mediated, not only in the sense of the visual, but also in the sense of the medical, plays a key role in this creation of this thing we're calling the spectacle. And with the narrowing of the concept of normal and the public visibility that's creating this spectacle, one of the other key main themes for the readings for this week is how this binary distinction between us and them, us being the normal, them being the freak. Now, that all gets turned on its head when you're talking about sort of feminist ethics or disability ethics, which hopefully I think some of the pieces for this week did bring those other perspectives in. That if I'm spent this whole class saying there's no objective truth, I can't, us and them are variable. But what's key is the extent to which power has to play into this equation as well, and the power of and the pervasiveness of medical ideology that we laid out in the first unit. And again, when I say medical ideology, I'm not just talking about sort of med education or medical practice. It's sort of the medico-industrial complex, which encompasses a particular ideology which has a relationship to particular forms of practice. In the form of a slinky, reflect and refract each other. So the pervasiveness of that medical ideology on our conceptions of self and the extent to which that ideology is influenced by, I put medical technology, but I sort of mean medical and the mediated, the visual technologies. So I'm going to check in a lot to see if I'm making sense this evening. Does that make sense? Okay. So the main premise of the argument for the week is that when we're looking at these images of, and we'll just call them freaks, why not? Because it's an easy shorthand. It's used throughout. It's being reappropriated. So take freaks as a shorthand for all these other extraordinary bodies that we talked about last week. We can understand our reaction, and if we're placing ourselves in the category of normal, then we're talking about our society's reaction to them in terms of this binary, or the division between self and other. But then also to always keep in mind that it's not just a philosophical or psychological characteristic of humans, that it's also very historically and socially contextual how we're doing that and why we're doing it. not everybody necessarily has to agree, but we all have to at least agree that that's one of the central premises of where we are with this unit on the body as spectacle. Anybody want to argue against that or question it? Or all right, we'll leave it as a, what does a lawyer say? Stipulate it? Or yeah, Shana.
This isn't really, it's kind of just a tangential point, but I guess what's interesting to me was a lot of the articles talked about how the freaks, in kind of self-preservation, society decided to preserve them and not exploit them as shows, but in that they took away, I guess, the only sense of identity a lot of the freaks themselves had. And I think that in that sense, our reaction as kind of protectors of these people to their detriment sort of has plays into this, I guess, but I'm not quite sure where I'm going with that in relation to this comment.
Oh, I love that point.
But I guess what I was reminded of is I took a public health policy class last year about, and we had a guest speaker who talked about the sex trade in India and how the fact that people looked down upon it was actually the most dangerous part about it for these people, because then there was no policing and they had created their own police force within themselves. And basically about how protecting prostitutes by making it immoral and saying that no one should ever have to do such a thing instead of encouraging them and, you know, allowing them to, it really hurt this really ostracized group. And I think that's the sort of same thing with freaks.
I think it was Dennett. And she does this as a throwaway line, and I had it in the slides and I took it out because I wasn't quite sure how I wanted to talk about it, but I'll throw it in here. It's the statement on page 319 where she says, this is after she goes through the 20th century and rising disability rights activists and sort of affirmative action type programs. She says, ironically, however, freak shows provided more independence to some disabled people of the past century than do today's affirmative action programs. Is that related to sort of where you were going?
Yeah, I think so. Because in the freak show, I think they took some control over what they were. Mm-hmm. Especially when you're seeing, and you see that in that you have normal people, or quote, normal people, who are becoming freaks. And I think that when they had an entire industry like that where it was a money-making thing, it really validated it. Mm-hmm. Whereas, I guess, sort of, so in the affirmative action thing, I'm trying to remember exactly what her perspective was, but I do think it was more validating than affirmative action can be today. Mm-hmm. And that kind of opens up.
Which we don't really want to go all the way there.
debate.
Yeah. Different class.
Yeah, totally different class.
Well, I think the two things, that this idea that we have to sort of protect or take charge of, or we think we know best, or, you know, we have the authority because we have this ideology and view of the world, we see that in the conjoined twins articles as well. We see it in the cosmetic surgery article. In fact, that's one of the discussion questions, is this question of empowerment versus oppression. Very similar question to informed consent in vulnerable communities. How informed can informed consent be? Because if informed consent is based on an idealistic principle of autonomy, and I've given a broken record on this one, autonomy without agency, I don't think is real true autonomy, but that's how we build informed consent. That's how we understand this notion of empowerment. But, you know, I think we talked in the beginning too, like, people can rebel, but they rebel in very predictable ways. And so how free is that choice? So let's remember that at the end of class when we get to the discussion period.
It's the questions. Legal prostitution ever a good thing? Is it? It can become a kind of a profession, but is there a real freedom to choose to be part of that profession? Even if it's legalized, even there's health benefits, there's an expected salary, there's protection from abuse. Is it still at its base a good thing to have as a society. Even the fixtures, even those who were benefited financially from those, the baseline, the premises was that they are an exhibit in this live theater because of their freakiness, because of their
otherness, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's not just other. It's not like exotic other, like foreign countries. It's because it's an other in a way that it is definitely not normal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not normal in an extreme and not positive way.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line is that it's not a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they were able to be more successful in benefiting more financially from that, or were better performers, but the baseline was that it wasn't really a positive identity to hold.
Mm-hmm. But then you got to talk about the historical and socially contextual landscape. So that, you know, to take the prostitution example, what are your goals with either outlawing or regulating prostitution? If your goals are protection of women, then outlawing, it's not going to work, because it's going to happen anyway because of the historical and social structure in which we're in. So different questions will lead to different answers on ethicality or acceptability, those sorts of things. And I think, well, I don't want to get, I don't like historical ethics type of things where you take the present and analyze the past to make an ethical judgment on it. But in terms of to understand it, we can understand prostitution today and freak shows the same way in terms of limited options. Not just limited, but very prescribed options for how the, which we'll get to in like three slides, how the socio-political body relates to individual socially constructed bodies and that dependent relationship between the two. So let's keep going, because I actually started my clock today. We're already at 12 minutes and we're only on slide two. So ideology and epistemology underline the self, others, us, them, normal, abnormal bodily divide. I think what's interesting too, particularly coming out of our unit on embodiment and patienthood, is the question of the notion of what is the self. Again, sort of reiterates itself, and the ethics and politics of representation. So here we go: bodies and social ideology. You know, this is also was reflected in Nancy Shepherd Hughes' article from week one or two, that human bodies and social bodies are related, and we're oversimplifying this drastically, but we'll just tell it by a common metaphor, how the perceived functionality of an individual, different organs working in synchronicity, a very functional arrangement within the body, mirrored and was a metaphor to different organs and limbs and parts of the social body. And you see that reflected in the language. Heads of state, student bodies, members of organizations. The assumption being that bodies and societies are each systematically ordered, assemblages of elements, in which their relationship, in which each sort of becomes important, or all become important, because of the relationship they have with each other. This idea of an organic functionalism. Every part serves a purpose, but the purposes really only become relevant as they combine and function as a whole. I like very much in this simplified overview of human bodies and social bodies, this idea that meaning comes from relationships with the other parts. I think that's integral to social constructionism, integral to an anthropological perspective on what we're doing, or, you know, how the world works. But it is too simplistic. And that's the problem, is it does not take power into account. Because it's one thing to say, you know, oh, they all interrelate and they work together. That sounds like, you know, kumbaya elementary, you know, preschool, when really the world was more like high school. hellish and filled with arbitrary hierarchies. would never go back.
rebellion.
Right. Exactly. That's heated social change. You could go. You could keep. Knowing me particularly, unlimited semiosis. I could go forever on that one with the hormones and the physiological development. A better way to look at the relationship between individual bodies and society is that it's not just a functional sort of metaphoric equivalency, but a more complex interweaving. So it's a complex, an interweaving of these culturally constructed bodies. And every time I'm giving you a little bit more anthropological language here, and then I tell you sort of what it is before. So culturally constructed bodies that both personify that reflection and are transformed by, and also feed back into that soup, by the sociocultural practices and phenomena surrounding this person. So think embodied body selves in action and context. Think of the slinky. Think of reflection and refraction. That's culturally constructed bodies, with bodies sociopolitical, which are these social and political formations and institutions, which are, to circle that back, are led and directed by particularly culturally constructed bodies, based on socio-historical context with economics, politics, religion, all of these things that don't just have a one-tiered filter, but have multiple-tiered filters, so that if you are the right person at the right time socio-historically, you are more likely positioned in positioned differently than others. And so that's the sort of perpetuation of power. This comes back to this notion of habitus, which I think I don't know where I got these. I'm sure I stole them from Wikipedia, so I will just announce that and absolve myself of any plagiarism accusations. The idea that the way in which bodies socio-political influence culturally constructed bodies is through this notion of habitus. And he says, this is Bourdieu, they're not states of minds or beliefs, they're states of the body. There's a quote at the bottom from a sociologist who says, in everyday life we must have society in our bones. I like that. I think that's a very simple, like, touchstone to come back to when you think of habitus, that it does, it permeates. In the same way we all, I think, enjoyed and appreciated sort of embodiment theory and habitus go hand in hand. So why am I talking about all this again? I'm talking about all this again because when you talk about habitus, we've talked about how we've seen it reflected in an individual practitioner. We've seen it how it's reflected in the patient experience. But it's also visible in public culture and media. It's visible through TV, film, art museum, art exhibits, museums, all of these types of things. That you can use public culture and media as research entry points to what this habitus is. So that's really where these readings for this week are coming from. The Modern Day Freak Show, how autism is represented visually, and new sort of medical social trends. Okay, are we good so far? Okay. Dennett. Let's start there. The whole book, if you like this chapter and you like this topic, it's Rosemary Garland Thompson edited it. All of the chapters are fantastic. And it was really hard because I think originally in my draft of the syllabus I had like four of the different chapters, and this week I'm like nine articles in 1 week. From Wonder to Error, or is that her genealogy? It's in the syllabus, I think I put it there. And I don't actually have it, or else I'd loan it to you. But I have some other chapters. So Dennett, she is looking at contemporary versions of sort of 19th, early 20th century freak shows. started in the Dime Museum. She says, the freak show was and is about spectacle. It is a place where human deviance is enhanced, dressed, coiffed, and propped up for the entertainment of a paying audience. The freak show is about relationships, us versus them, the normal versus the freaks. It is about culture, which determines what is freakish and what is not. It is about the human body. It is about psychology and deviant behavior. It is about the relationship between the public and private. As I was reading through the readings for this week, I kept thinking how, because last time I taught this class, I had this unit second. Or we know we're second now. No, are we third? Okay. I had it second, and it makes so much more sense now, because as I was rereading it and preparing for tonight, I was like, oh, we've already talked about that theme. We've talked about that theme. So then this is her summary at the end of the chapter. But that's why I said take some extra time on your paper so that you can read all these, because this is the point in which everything's going to start to come together. So let's see how she lays out this story. This is her conclusion. Let's see how she gets there. She gives, I think, a very nice history of the development and then the sort of devolution of Dime Museum freak shows. And she starts very briefly with this idea of what was around before the Dime Museum. You know, because it's not like Barnum invented the freak. You know, there were always people who were different. At what point they became public spectacle, much obviously later than... I want to get into that. Itinerant performers, not a lot of opportunities. You know, sort of, she describes it as sort of backwards barns, you know, storm show, not barnstorming shows, is that what they're called? Or tent raising. You know, they pull into town, they put up a tent, put on a show, get a whole bunch of money, and roll out. Then it was with the Dime Museum that the freak. It no longer is just an oddity, but really starts to become a commodity. And there are pluses and minuses to being a commodity. You know, I think we all sort of know the minuses. You've lost part of your individuality, your identity. You give up some of your self-control because you are being managed by somebody else. But in a historical and social context in which there are very limited options, this was one of the better ones. Dime Museum performers were making more than stage performers, you know, certain ones. There was some level of respectability, and it was obviously not glamorous, but cheap housing, relatively, and, you know, like I said, relatively higher salaries. And then as the Dime Museum, and we'll talk later about why these changes happen, this is just sort of the overview, as the Dime Museum transitions into more of a sideshow, you know, that would go along with the circus, that would lose some of the veneer of respectability of a Dime Museum, you have rising levels of fakery, you have greater exaggeration, you have even more superlatives. Any CSI Las Vegas fans? In the room? They did an episode a couple months ago with a Las Vegas freak show with all the sort of self-made or novelty artist freaks. She actually was not murdered. She was an accidental sword swallowing. But what's interesting and what is important in this trajectory to bring us to the present, to bring us to conjoined twins and talk show guests and that sort of thing, is really this linchpin of being a commodity. I'm going to pick on, do you remember in our class last semester we had that article about once a commodity, always a commodity? We were talking about organ transplantation, mm-hmm. and the idea, you know, debating the ethics of payment or compensation for donation, compensated donation. And one of the main criticisms is that once you commodify something of the body, you can never take it back. You can never go from a commodity to a not commodity status. And do you remember, because it was a great set of examples. So I'm thinking of the Israeli Daycare Center. All right, I was going to see if someone else wanted to talk, but it was a sort of natural-ish experiment. An Israeli daycare center noticed that they were starting to have a greater problem with parents coming late, to the point where they thought, we need to do something about this. And they instituted a fee. You know, a couple bucks for 15 minutes, a little bit more. I've paid my share of those fees here. And what they found was, once the daycare people's time was commoditized, more and more parents just came late because they thought, whereas before it was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry that I'm late. Now it was like, all right, how much do I owe you? Okay, 20 bucks, here you go. And now I'm blanking on the other examples, but I think I love that daycare example. And it's time, which is somewhat related to, but it's, you know, it's human labor, a person. So once a commodity, always a commodity. Let's remember that as we keep going. Here's where both of the articles make this argument, but slightly differently. They want to differing degrees, obviously, Josie, it's a woman. And does anybody speak or know how to pronounce Dutch? Because I used to always say Jose van Dyck, which I don't think is right. But she's a woman, so she's Josie. And I don't know how to pronounce her last name. Anyway, how she's coming about it is much more from a medical perspective with the conjoined twins. But they both want to give a role to medicine and medical ideology and the pervasiveness of medical authority. So Dennett, in talking about the early years of the Dime Show or the Dime Museum, talks about modern medicine being very much in its infancy. So the average person, she's arguing, had a fear of being maimed, incurably different, unalterably normal. And in that way, in the same way as those of you who've done art history, the memento moris, you know, this idea that it's sort of there are these elaborate creations where it might have a fetal skeleton, a dead rose, a stuffed bird. The idea being that there are things that are beautiful in death that we are supposed to reflect then back on our own lives. They were incredibly popular. It was very strange. I mean, but you could spend a lot of money on these, you know, the people became known for them, particularly early practitioners who had access to all these different specimens, you know, fetal skeletons, who could use them in their memento moris. But this idea that in the same way, we have a sort of desire to behold others' misfortunes because it, in the same way we would behold death to reflect on the beauty of life, sort of to reflect on our own fortunes, to be thankful to, you know, however bad we think we have it, at least we're not that bad sort of thing. That's where the sort of the psychology and the physiology and the social sort of all interrelate. They talk about the medical authority of the Dime Museum, you know, that adding science was a way to alleviate the threat to the viewer. Because if you could, you know, you have some lizard boy up on stage, you know, in 1910, people, you know, they couldn't go to the internet and find out how Lizard Boy was, you know, what is it about Lizard Boy or the hairy people, you know. So you could imagine it. Gilman laid this out in last couple weeks. With the unknown comes a unease. So the adding the science to explain it helped take away the personal fear of what they were seeing. That's, I mean, for each of us to sort of, I think her story still resonates and has a lot of lessons, even if we don't want to go all the way to, we have an innate desire to behold others' misfortunes. We can talk about that in our discussion part. So what happens? what happens is, you know, when modern medicine emerges from its infancy, we have a greater awareness of awareness of sort of genetics. We think we have, we hold stronger now than we ever have in the past that the promise of medicine is going to cure us of all of our ills. So that there's not so much a fear of physical abnormality anymore. And so that, sort of what's happening in medicine, coupled with what's happening in society more in general, with rising disability awareness, lower acceptability of being able to profit from others, rising ideology that's basically, you know what, your body is your personal canvas. You know, you could do almost whatever you want to it. You know, it's always sort of a strange point, because whenever I see people who have, you know, the big ear plugs and the nose plugs and the pins up here, I'm so practiced that I sometimes think they're surprised by me, because I just look them right in the eye. You know, I've gotten really good at not flinching, because part of it is, yeah, they this idea that self-made freaks are everywhere. But there's still this desire for an outlet to manage the fear of deviance, of difference. But how we've defined that difference has changed. Very similar in the way that Gilman was talking about how we have this whole visual iconography of sexually transmitted diseases that came with syphilis. We cured syphilis, but there's still this need, social need, to locate, visualize, contain, control, separate that which is different. So we have this social, cultural need, which is no longer being met by the dime museum and the freak show as much. I mean, you can still, you know, Las Vegas, Coney Island, you know, Barnum's, believe it or not, exhibits. So it's not completely, but it's no longer as publicly acceptable to gawk in the way that it used to be. Okay, yes.
I found it very powerful when she said that one of the reasons for the fall of the dying museums is the returning soldiers from the first
world. Yes.
I found it very powerful. Very insightful and powerful, because it blurred the lines between them and us in terms of disability. Mm-hmm. Because those returning soldiers were part of us, the collective us. Mm-hmm. And when they became a different body, as a collective, we had to change our views of disability. It's mm-hmm. not longer out there, it's part of us. And it's also part of the responsibility society, mm-hmm. too, because it's. We send them there, we have to accept them back.
And is there a court? When was the ADA passed?
1990.
That late?
Oh, yes.
Jeez. Okay. Never mind.
It's actually, revised a few years ago, it was revised because it wasn't. Mm-hmm. The way it was interpreted was very narrow and wasn't affecting people with disabilities.
Yeah, but this idea, you're exactly, I think you pulled out something really key, is that before, these freaks were either, you know, biological or natural or foreign. They were more clearly not us. But when these soldiers coming back, they're definitely us. So that's why I was hoping that the seeds for the ADA were planted about this time, when they realized that accommodations actually had to be made, because society always finds a way to manage difference. When nobody had an investment, when it was truly the powerless who were so different, it was easier to give them the option of, you know, sort of freak show or this sort of thing.
The seeds of the disability rights movement were definitely, we started the seeds. Mm-hmm. Started with returning veterans.
Okay.
World War First, and then Second, and then Vietnam, and so on and so forth.
So we can trace that slinky thread back.
Yeah. Seeds.
Yes. Okay. So where does this leave us? It leaves us with Jerry Springer. I really tried hard to find like a short clip that had, you know, a midget and a, you know, something like. But it was like Ku Klux Klan midgets, and I thought fighting. So I just did a screen grab of the YouTube titles, just to, you know. I think we've all seen Jerry Springer. I'll admit it. So this is where we end up with talk shows as modern day freak shows. Sune. And Dennett poses the question, what kind of exhibition would be grotesquely fascinating, politically correct, and a sure draw? Psychological freaks parading in front of an audience. Dysfunctional, you know, is, I think, is another term she uses. But what I think is interesting, at one point she says, almost as sort of a throwaway, she says, promoters had to find an outlet for this. And I don't think she spent enough time talking about where is the true crux of this impetus? Is it with promoters? Is it with, you know, capitalistic middlemen who want to find another way to make money off of, in the same way that Barnum did, just a different type of other? Is it us, the audience, who needed this in some way? Was it, in this case, the freaks themselves, you know, in a society in which we all believe truly that we can have our 15 minutes of fame and that's going to change our lives irrevocably for the better? You know, being on TV is what everyone supposedly aspires to. So I thought that was an interesting question about where did this really come from? You know, it's, or is it just one of those things where it's so interwoven, a whole host of factors hit at the right time. Did anybody else find that in any way problematic or interesting? Or not that I think it needs an answer, but if somebody had already thought about it, I'd love to hear what you've already thought about. All right, well, we can think about that and talk about it in our discussion. I think Dennett does a really good job of showing the relationships between the freak show and the talk show. The hosts as lecturers, this idea of gradual introductions of guests to heighten the drama as it goes on, incredible voyeurism and shock value, while still playing up the educational aspects. And I'm sure, has everybody in this room seen a daytime talk show? Like a Donahue or a Sally Jesse Raphael or an Oprah. Oprah in Tanzania?
Yeah.
So you know, she's everywhere. And it is always so interesting. And that's why I loved when I found this Alice Dreger commentary. Because I had never seen that perspective before. You could always sort of wonder, you know, and I have. Who are these people? They've got, you know, big letters after their name. They're professors in certain places, and they agree to sit in the audience and say three things and get talked over. I mean, they don't really have the experts on Jerry Springer, but, you know, in the more respectable talk shows. So this idea of this business, I thought it was so eloquently put. And also brings in some of the ethics that Dennett doesn't focus on because she's more of a social historian. These shows are not improving the lives of people. In fact, there's that classic case of the guy who killed his secret lover because his secret lover, or not his secret lover, that doesn't make any sense, secret admirer, because the secret admirer was a fellow man. And I love her discussion of her conversations with the booker or whoever the assistant is. You know, who is this guy? Oh, you know, he's a businessman. He's married. He's got some kids. He's basically fine. Well, if he's fine, why don't you leave him alone? And her question of, her, you know, do I recognize that it's going to happen anyway? And do I try to mitigate the circus? Or would my presence there legitimize the circus? And her solution to ask for a whole lot of money. And that little dialogue. Well, is the cab driver that's going to pick me up going to get paid? Yeah. Is the makeup artist going to get paid? Yeah. Is the engineer going to get paid? Yeah. Is the host going to get paid? Yeah. Is your, you know, is your subject going to get paid? No, this is journalism. Once a commodity, always a commodity. Something that is used for the profit of others.
Also, like the self-identity of journalism, I mean, I would contest it. It's not exactly journalism, but the perception is that we are, you know, recording the truth, truth, we're recording life out there. And that is part of us, but not really us. So I think it's interesting. The show views itself as journalism, and it's entertainment.
Right, maybe in the same way that, you know, Barnum called it a museum. You know, you find what is the arbiter of veracity.
It's also a way of self-acquiring reputation or legitimacy. Journalism is more valued, more closer to the truth than entertainment. Such as museum more than a circus or theater. Just a show.
Right. It's like the Franklin Institute. They put a lot of money in their marketing campaign, I don't know how many years ago, to really sort of get this idea of edutainment. That it's education and it's entertainment. That's how you get the kids. And to validate the concept of entertainment in an educational setting. All right, I don't have time for this, but I'll put it up on the... You can look at it if you want. There's a... he makes his living as a comedian. His name is David Roche. He is facially very disfigured. He has some sort of benign but disfiguring tumor. And he travels to schools, you know, and it's cute because he makes all the young kids ask him all in unison, "What happened to your face?" He says, "I'm so glad you asked." So I liked it because it was, to me, analogous to Rosemary Garland Thompson's, where we talked about last week, with this idea of empowering the starer. Because he's like, you know what, the first 10 minutes, I'll give that to anybody. You can stare at me for 10 minutes. It's what you do after that 10 minutes that matters. It's like, I'm not going to judge you for looking. It's different. So I'm sure he has. He also has not like a TED talk, but he has longer things online. So you could just Google David or YouTube David Roche. All right. So I am sort of barreling through, but because I do want to leave an hour for all of us to discuss, so we're going to do some, you know, sort of group and then presentation me kind of stuff. So let's switch gears to still stick on TV, but go with this idea of medical documentaries. I'm just going to call her Josie. Starts her piece by talking about watching a TV show featuring liposuction of a 350-pound man. You can tell this piece was written a long time ago, because what is it now? It's 700-pound men on TLC. 1,400-pound couples, you know. I'm having trouble defining the genre of this program. Is this medical information or is it plain entertainment? So that's how she leads into it. And so she... much more explicitly than Dennett, talks about the medicalization of society and how developments of screening, techniques, treatments, surgeries led to the decline of freaks as traditionally defined. I mean, the times that I find myself actually caught is not the piercings and the plugs and the tattoos, it's the guys with the giant goiters on their neck. Because that, like, really? You know, and your first thought is, why haven't you taken care of that? And then you realize, well, you know, there's a whole host of reasons why this person hasn't, you know, still has this thing on their neck. So, no longer monstrosities, but unfortunate individuals in need of medical help. I put myself out there just to sort of say that if you've had that thought, you know, it's, we're all in the society together, that... Of course we're going to have that thought at some level. So the rise of medicalization, the decline of traditional freaks, paved the way for what she's calling medicalized freaks. Which I think is fascinating because it also, in that idea, an adjective? Yes, an adjective of medicalized, it switches the power it involves more power dynamics and switches it to the side of medicine. She says it's no longer the fat man himself who draws the crowds. It's the filmed operation. It's the medical team. It's the heroes who are there to save the freak. And so there's that, remember we started today with the talking about medicalized and mediated? She says, we would be embarrassed to openly gaze at the physically challenged exposing themselves on stage, but we'll eagerly sit in our living rooms by ourselves and watch. So the freak gets a savior, and that's the cultural hero. So she lays out three historical moments in this trajectory. So, and again, in the same way that Dennett did, I think nice, clear, logical breaking down of these different periods. So she starts with a film from 1898, Dr. Doyon and the Nyack sisters, which was he was a surgeon who, I can't remember if it was one of the first, or a pioneer, who had a very tight camera to just the hands of different operations, of the sisters. Truly to be a didactic instrument. You know, that you can't, you know, the idea of a surgical theater no longer works, particularly if you're doing something so microscopic. Here's a way he could teach others, show off, gain prestige, of course all these things that come with it. And I like the story of how he didn't understand why he was being criticized until he found out that one of his assistants was selling it outside of medical arenas. So even, you know, 1898, for a didactic hands, lay people were still interested in that without the narrative that comes in the example of from these 1950s Dutch documentaries, where you start to have more of the, a little bit of the case studies, the shift from purely scientific interest in the visual recording of a novel or complicated surgical procedure to a more hybrid interest of the physicians as well as the patient, which she says reaches its pinnacle in this 1995 Nova special, PBS Siamese Twins. And she calls it sort of this pinnacle because as the narrative came about, as narrative became acceptable to include in medical documentaries, you start to have more dramatization, which she says makes perfect sense because so many of these things are inherent to this type of medicine anyway. Potentially a life or death struggle. You know, it's high technology, it's novel, it's science fiction-y perhaps. You've got the heroes and the helpless victims. That it matches it as it has been proscribed and embodied, developed, constructed in this trajectory. Mirrors drama, fictionalized drama. Okay, so she says we have these products which are glossy. They've got better editing. They've got wide angles. They've got narrow angles. They've got interviews with the patient, in this case, the patient's, you know, adoptive parents and the physicians and all the care team. That she argues, which I think we've seen before when we talk about visual media, imbues something with a heightened sense of real. You're watching it. They're laying out the story. It's matching a style which we're very familiar with. Anybody who reads any type of pleasure book has seen this formula. But we know it's not true. So this has this veneer of transparency that, you know, what we're seeing is what really happened. So I want, and this, some of these other things that I'm going to say in the next couple slides are in another article from that Wonder to Error book. But they are some of the questions, factors, relationships that are masked by the veneer of transparency that we as ethicists and ethically minded people involved in medicine should pay attention to. Because again, remember, this kind of stuff is feeding back into the habitus of how the population who lives in that habitus understands the other, how they understand Siamese twins, how they understand the medical team. So we need to deconstruct those public cultural products. Okay, so complete, and I also can't find even any clips of this thing. PBS is notoriously tight with their visual products. Nothing leaks online. They must have a whole team of interns just searching for people illegally putting stuff up. I forgot your card. Matthew found the picture. So you can call off the hunt for the thing that I was looking for last week.
Good job.
Yeah. So I don't know if anyone could find me a pirated copy of PBS. Who works at CHOP? It's got to be somewhere. I might owe you $40 by the time this class is over.
Ben might be able to find it.
Really?
She's in the NICU.
Ooh, I'll email her. I think it's all camaraderie. It's all part of being part of the, even though they're not related, the pen shop system. Okay, so let me just sort of back up and just sort of give a... It's exactly what you would expect it to be. And Josie talks about it a little bit, you know. Coming off the plane, landing in Philadelphia, there's the shop of CHOP. You know, we enter the halls. It's pristine. It's deep-voiced narration. It's seriousness. It's the doctors going, you know, trying to look at the x-rays. It's the drawing on the little girl's bodies, you know. It's the heavy music. I mean, we all know what this is, right? Okay. So... one of the main problems in this veneer of transparency is that there's almost a complete absence of any ethical discussion. The questions in the film, the points of questioning, of pausing, are all surgical. They're never ethical, epistemological, or phenomenological. Despite the fact, as she says, that these two twins, Dao and Duan, embody all of those, they embody ethics, epistemology. How do we know what it is to be a person? Are you one person? Are you two people? Are you one body? Are you two bodies? And phenomenology. How would they go through the world? Should the operation be performed? Not asked. Not discussed. Not to say it wasn't on some level. You know, it had, somebody must have brought it up and somebody must have said yes. How much discussion was there? Don't know. But it's not in the film. No discussion of how these young girls, any psychological implications of the separation. Only in passing is it mentioned, and only after the operation. She makes, I think, a good argument that, and we've had this idea of post-colonialism and colonialism come up a few times before, as a metaphor for things that are not quite colonialism proper, but this idea of bodily colonialism, to use the metaphor and the analogy of an outside powerful body, social body, coming in to have control over socially constructed individual bodies, is represented, she and others argue, in this almost complete lack of attention given to the girls' lives prior to landing in Philadelphia. Not a single person in the film speaks to these girls in their own language. And I think some of her examples of how the narrator talks, which again, you know, we all know, it's that classic, you know, like trailer voice. Speaking of voice, the girls in the film, we've spent this whole semester almost, you know, talking about telling the desire for bodies to tell stories, the need to communicate, the need for empowerment. These girls are completely mute by virtue of a language barrier, but also their age. They're so young. Viewers are told by this narrator that these girls' greatest desire is to be separated. Really? it's a girl's wish, or, as she or somebody else argues, is it the narrator speaking on our behalf, in which we are presumed to be in a habitus, to be in a culturally constructed social body that values self-sufficiency, that values autonomy, that values individual will, both economically and bodily? Is that our wish being reflected on these young girls? Because again, remember, a lot of anthropologists will talk about sort of these, Siamese twins are the perfect example of not one or the other. You know, they're not two, but they're not one. And that ambiguity is so, what's her name? Margaret Mead's daughter? Purity and Filth or something? Purity and Sin? I don't know, it's a classic. That there is something to that ambiguity that we culturally can't deal with. Let's see if I can get some voice. In light of particularly this class, less so ethics proper, but this class anyway, questions of embodiment are glossed over. Unaddressed questions of the complexity of what is this body? One body, two bodies. And the actions in the film, in terms of, so it's not asked, should we separate them? So once you just assume that decision is natural, of course, because of what we value as a society, one useful agent assumed to be more valuable than two disabled agents, you take your decision making then is limited, because you haven't questioned it, is limited to the surgical, the physiological, the questions of viability. When they open her up, that's when they start the discussion of which girl is going to receive which organ. And they're making that decision based on which one they think has a better chance of surviving. So I think, you know, again, it's one of those things where probably a lot of us are thinking, well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, of course. Why would you, you know, give an organ to the one that was weaker? This is one of those things where sort of like you have to just go back and just sort of trust that mantra that there is nothing natural about any decision. You know, there is a value behind that initial decision which then put us on a path to be limited in the other kinds of questions we could ask. Is that there's sort of an irony, is that as conjoined twins, they had a particular value. And not just an exchange value in terms of, you know, they could get donations for this, because as the adoptive parent said, the insurance didn't cover this. And also wouldn't cover sort of the, if there were eventually prosthetics or operations to sort of correct physiological changes as these girls grow up. They become simply two seriously disabled Asian American children. The operation has normalized their handicap, and the media generally pay little attention to ordinary children with ordinary handicaps. Not just the media, society as well. And I want to show you, this has not been updated. Let's see. Not this one, this one. The Dao and Duan Siamese Twins information page. There they are. They're cute. I'll just let you read that. I mean, I to keep sort of the themes of voice and colonialism. At one point they do say, you know, the girls have approved what's been put on here. But notice, who are the girls now? Katie and Julie. So this link is also in the slides, and you can feel free on your own time to read their story.
It's also when such a transformation happens to one's body, sometimes there's a need to capture that transformation with a new name, which is part of a new identity.
Yeah.
It's definitely colonialized in the sense that you could have chosen more Asian or Thai names, for example. I'm sure it's part of their attempt to give some privacy. It's definitely part.
That's generous.
It's definitely smells of colonialism.
This page has not been updated since 2005. Oops, where'd the pictures go? Truly in progress. I think this is all the pictures there are. I think that's mom and brothers. That's grandma. So you see, this is the one that got the third leg, but then it didn't survive. Or one of them got a separate leg. Or they got the third one. Yeah, because that's her brother. Oops. There we go. They're cute kids. Julie about to kick a field goal using brother Justin's head. Anyway, okay, so. I wanted to throw that up there since I couldn't find any of the clips from the actual. How do you start from where you are? Somebody had to. Oh. Just walk back and do that again. I am becoming a computer idiot. Okay. Oh, I did it in an hour. That's exactly what I wanted to do. Okay. So I have laid out some of the things that I thought were some of the key themes from the mediated pieces. What I want to do in the next hour is maybe just divide us into four groups. It almost doesn't matter because I just want them small enough that everybody gets a chance to talk. And we're not going to do a formal jigsaw. I just want everyone to talk and then share. And what we'll do is focus on the Sarit piece about trapped children. And I just wanted to show some of the, because she talked about the puzzle pieces, but they're everywhere. I think that was sort of really clever with the top right one with the person's head. And then female genital cosmetic surgery. Not that I'm going to show any clips of that, but because they talk about this a lot, I don't know if anybody looked this up, and I apologize if anybody is offended. There are so many art exhibits about vaginas now. It is crazy. I love this. The Great Wall of Vagina. Look how many panels.
Oh,
it keeps going and going and going and going and going. And there may even be more. Petals. But all of these are, and they're interesting because this woman is writing, or not this woman, Tiefler. This is that New View campaign that she was talking about. Challenging the medicalization of sex. pleasure or their our pleasure or their profit. So all of these links are up there. And they sort of link to a lot of these other, and they all have a similar mission. There's feminist groups all over this country working on female empowerment and sex ed. You know, to try to convince young and old women that there can be more than one style of vagina. That cracks me up. Here you can get a poster. So, now that we all know what we're dealing with, how many people do we have tonight? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. All right, let's do 3, 3, 3, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, Hila and Christina, you can be on the set too. You guys, I'm just going to pick, you guys are going to be autism. You guys are going to be genital surgery. And these are, you know, again, these are what I would like you to at least start with, but if you find yourselves going off in a different direction, please do. So, this, and I'll just, we'll go over the questions for everybody so you can see where the other groups are going too. The trapped children piece, this is one of those ones too that I thought every other paragraph I was like, we've talked about that, we've talked about that, we've talked about that. And it's all sort of coming together in this social history of the representation of autism. If you haven't figured this out by now, I love this idea of sort of contextualized social histories. It's just the perfect anthropological way of looking at something. She mentions the nature of photography, multivocality of images, how images take on a life of their own, which I think is fascinating. It shows that you can't control no matter how much we think we can. Talked about reality, the nature of reality, how reality is related to what we see and what we create to be seen. Making visible a non-existent physical difference. This idea of the ethics of ocularity, the ethics of seeing, the ethics of witnessing, she talks about that in there. Talks about the biomedicalization of behavior. So, themes in general, you know, and whatever one, other ones you found, try to, again, as most things in this class, combine the social, the anthropological with the bioethics perspective. And then go over the two main themes, fragmentation and imprisonment, how she defines them and how they're evidenced. And then do an evaluation of her argument. And then the Tiefer piece, some of these first, this whole first chunk of questions has to do with plastic surgery in general. Because that's where ethics in plastic surgery is, while not a huge subfield, you know, Anita Allen spent some time talking about this, there's the critique that it violates a do-no-harm principle. So unpack that. So unpack it by sort of what is the unwritten definition of harm that this critique is implying? What does it assume about plastic surgery, about the body, about the relationship between the body and the self? To me, there's a very clear presumption behind that critique. Ethical considerations for informed consent for elective cosmetic procedures. And she has a section in there which talks about this idea of affirmative warning. And then if you feel that there are sufficient differences, then sort of unpack the critique in particular to this form of cosmetic surgery. Think about social history of this procedure. She does a great job unpacking the business end, the publicity end. You know, the glut. Is that a glut? Is a lot? Mm-hmm. Okay. Versus dearth. Okay. Glut of surgeons that are graduates. You know, the insurance industry limiting the amount of money that can be reimbursed. I mean, she does exactly this idea of a social history to understand that you got to come at it from all different angles. Distinction between treatment and enhancement in general. And we already probably have a clear understanding of the ethics of treatment, but what does an ethics of enhancement look like? And this is going to be a huge ethical issue as we move forward, as we start to have, I mean, Jonathan Moreno talked about this last semester, and I think we'll talk about our neuroethics in the fall. And then I put this last little point in here, because I don't know exactly why, because I have not spent a lot of time thinking about this topic, but on a gut level, which is how they always sort of say, that's something, that's the point where you know there's something to be thought about more, I make a real fundamental distinction between breast augmentation or a nose job and genitals cosmetic surgery. But why do I do that? I don't actually know. And would my argument for, if I'm going to make an ethical argument saying, sure, ethics of, there's no problem with breast augmentation or whatever else you want to do with your body, why do I still then have that about the genital surgery? So pretend like you're Art Kaplan, you know, and sort of editorialize, you know, not with like sort of deep philosophers, but see if you can get your perspective out there. And I realize that this one has a lot more questions than the first one. So after the autism, unless there's themes that you find yourself going off on, you know, try this treatment, the distinction between treatment and enhancement, and see where that takes you. Okay, cool. So just sort of hover in groups of three. And then, what time is it? Let's see. What do we think? 30 minutes? Would that be enough? 25? Is that too much? Too little? Should we start with 25? Because I want to have enough time to then talk as a group. 25 it is. Set my timer.
Are you this way or are you this way?
Who wants to be the? You guys want to be the record keeper? So all tonight can listen to you.
Awesome.
So just don't say anything. Do you wouldn't want other people to hear? I did meant to stop our conversation on that tape. It yeah. Set off 5 minutes before. I don't even remember what we said. It was probably nothing, but I didn't. So.
We were definitely
a last time, right? So, I think they were.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so.
The last time did she count?
Yeah, we just like
yeah, that's funny, right? Okay. Okay.
Just because it seems like such a like salient thing in our culture right now, like I feel like autism is like always, you know?
Yeah.
They get, I just saw like new autism famous people.
Oh yeah.
Your chances of winning yes car is like 1 in 7 billion, but a chance of being born with autism is like 1 in 100, and then it shows like a famous NASCAR guy and he says my niece has autism or something. So I think it's so. Out there.
Yeah. So now
they're getting famous people.
Yeah.
Like, look, it even happens to us, too.
Yeah.
I did this thing that only 1 billion people do, but my niece is like, they don't like
yeah.
So everybody needs to know about it. Which I think is defining in our culture, too. Like, what you're saying.
For sure.
Well, and there are a lot of, like, theories on, like, causation and, like, alliances of people that agree, like, or that, you know, think certain things and are promoting certain things. And, like, I don't know, just a lot of people seem to have opinions about this, whereas, like, with other conditions, it's, like, you know, that's, like, such a tragedy, but they don't really have, like, an opinion, you know?
Yeah, but so much of it's, like, the diagnosing of autism is just really, like, not standard. Like, there isn't, like, a generalizable way of, like, at least
like a blood test.
Yes, like, it's not like you have, like, this type of blood that's, like, I guess more concrete, but, I mean, you could argue that, too.
Sure.
But I mean, it's...
It's like on a spectrum?
Yeah, it's on a spectrum, too, and then it's, like, it's clinical judgment, but so much, so, like, when you go in, okay, so you take your kid into, like, a therapist's office, and, like, they have to get, like, an evaluation, and they have to get a diagnosis at some point before they take me in before insurance can, like, do anything.
Yeah.
And so, like, so much of that plays a role in, like, what insurance would also cover as far as prescriptions. And autism right now is one of those things that, like, insurance will cover. And as far as the actual, I don't know, diagnosis or, like, criteria of it, it's just kind of fudged, I think, a lot of times. And I think it's a popular diagnosis for whatever reason now than it was. And it's not like this is like the first childhood like condition, you know? Like ODD was like huge in like the 90s and like, excuse me, in like late 80s. And but it was like so much tied to class and it was much more like obvious. Sorry, I didn't.
No, keep going.
Like, yeah, so I don't know, like. Like, I didn't feel, like, bad for kids reading this article. It sounds horrible, but, like, I do feel bad for kids because, like, this sucks, you know, like, all of it. But it's just more, like, disappointing to me. The hype around diagnoses and, like, I don't know, some sort of, like, pleasure that's gained from, like, diagnosing or, like, there being a diagnosis, like, some form of, like, something like concrete, like, okay, now we have a diagnosis. But what does that mean?
Yeah.
Like, what does that do? Does that change, like, the problematic behavior of your autistic child?
No, but in, like, relation to pain, I guess, like, it legitimizes their behavior once there's, like, a formal diagnosis. Mm-hmm. You know, like, when someone has all this back pain and they don't know what's wrong with them, well, you don't have any back pain. But if someone has a child who's misbehaving, so it legitimizes their behavior.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of like the principle.
But, like you're saying, I wish there was something more concrete. Well, and if you're identifying, like, over-diagnosis as, you know, a huge issue, that has really problematic implications for people that have severe autism, and then, you know, it could, like, delegitimize their problems. You know what I'm saying?
Right. But I think, like,
not to say that people aren't going to believe them, but it's not going to be. It's just going to be, like, misunderstood because there's such a spectrum of, like, symptoms or treatments or efforts or whatever.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But it's kind of, like, sad that there needs to be that for people to feel legitimized in their own, like, body. And I think that's kind of, like, what...
Be that, like, a diagnosis?
Yeah, that, like, you need a diagnosis to be legitimate in whatever, like, outburst you have as, like, a kid. Like, or explain to a kid that it's this or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I hear what you're saying, that it's like it legitimizes the experience because it's something that's like, sometimes that's all people need.
It's crazy that society needs something like that.
That, like, yeah, that people, it's just really disempowering to people. Like, if I have a problem, like, I might just knock on the door and I'm not going to be like, oh, I have, like, this problem. And I don't want to be, like, prescribed something or someone, you know what I mean? So I see it goes like both ways, but I feel like I just think it's sad that people need to be labeled with a diagnosis to feel in whatever they're experiencing. Is that what you're, I feel like it's kind of like what you were saying.
But like, no, but I feel like it's a hard problem to like begin to solve, though, because I mean the way that people are trained is often through like kind of categorizing things, you know? So, you know, it's not reasonable to expect like, you know, a clinician to be able to like identify every single like symptom without kind of like having that category. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So
but those categories are just why are they those categories and not like something else? And like, who defines the criteria for these like categories and these diagnoses? And then like, what are we going off of? We're going off of like first-hand experiences if you're a parent, I guess, with a child who, I guess, has outbursts or whatever, or shows other symptoms that are like unusual in some way. Right, but it's like really, like it just really takes away any sort of like humanness to the child.
Takes away what?
Like the humanness of the child.
So what is it?
I don't know. Children are already pretty vulnerable.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So.
When we were talking about pain, the person, like the back pain,
just that
needs a diagnosis to say, yes, my pain is legitimate. So,
and it really makes sense in relationship to how that concept of normal is narrowed.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, behavior is a spectrum.
And then I guess there's always that argument where, like, what's their approach is not even necessary.
That's right.
What they're doing, what they're doing.
I was trying to include you.
Stop myself, though. No, I'm just like, you know.
The body one, I have two ideas.
But in the same way that it's, you know, problematic to have, like, over diagnosis or like a huge like spectrum and umbrella kind of, it's also not a good thing to have such a narrow like conception of this, you know, and I think that's what the imaging
is
pointing out, I guess.
We all think that,
yeah, could you say a little bit more about that?
Well, I mean, so your point was that like it's unfortunate that in order for people to be like understood, they have to have like a diagnosis, right?
Yeah. You don't
have to. Or like something that's like tangible.
Otherwise, it's
just something.
Yeah. What were you gonna say? Like, yeah, I'm really curious now.
Well, but at the same time, if there's someone that has like, you know, like somebody that like that's nonverbal, autistic, like. Maybe is more characterized by like some of these like descriptions than, I don't know, I'm just saying like those do exist.
They need the diagnosis in order to get certain things.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
That's sort of,
yeah, so it's like unfortunate, but like since there is like that imbalance in power, like that's what they have to do, you know, and this, it's helpful to people like that, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Is there a slippery slope? I
don't
know where you're
looking. Okay. So here's where I would ask that you just think about taking that slinky backwards, because you know, this idea that you can critique positive alternatives, you know, and I think it's so important, and that's, and I think it's one of my main jobs in teaching this department is not to, you know, get people who are going to, you know, storm the castle and change the world, but just this rising awareness, and then, you know, when you go to your work and you talk to other people, that pause, okay, well, this have to be this way. This is just the way the system ended up. So let's think about why the system ended up that way, which will then help us answer the question of the ethicality of these. Well, and the risk, you know, how do we make a diagnosis? Or just think, not raising
always
goal. Because yes, we want that category so that kids who need help can get it. But might there be alternative structural organizations or alternative ideologies, alternative epistemologies that would help us deal with those different bodies in a different, more just, or, you know, a different kind of way? But think about how the principles that have organized the ideology have led us to a particular point. In the same way that in the Siamese video, the unthinking answer to the question, should they be separate? Of course. That leads us down
to the problem. Path. Is not
it's interesting to think what would have happened if we went over this way. And then this is why I know that I'm not designed to be like a labor organizer myself. You know, I love just the intellectual practice of like trying to think about it.
Look at myself.
It's really weird. Like my husband is counterfactual. And then they, like, counterfactual.
It is, you know. So
basically, this is sort of a backwards counterfactual.
You know.
Well, so I mean, but if you are like bringing these points up in order to kind of like affect change, then what would, in the context of like this conversation, what would be the change that would be like most useful? Would it be a more like narrow concept of autism, or
sure?
I think it's fair to point out that, like, it's, you know, kind of like a shame that people need a diagnosis, but, like, okay, so moving forward, like, you know, how can, I guess, the most, like, patients be best served, I guess, so that you kind of take care of the people who do have more, like, typical symptoms, and then those who, like, are harder to, like, categorize.
Like, yeah, I know what you're saying.
I don't know, like, I'm just, because I, like, understand what she's saying, but, like, at the same time, like, you can only, like, intellectualize so much. So just, like, on the ground, like, what would that look like? You know, making changes.
Changes in policy, mental health policy. I mean, a lot of things, you know. I feel like,
yeah, I guess she did bring
it. Practically, like, in practice and working with, like, an autistic child, like, just to validate it, to validate whatever it is. And, it's like, I don't work with kids, and I don't want to work with kids, but a lot of my friends work with kids, and I've worked around the kids, and I've seen a lot. It's just kind of like learning their language.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of moving away from, like, that modern way of it's kind of like you're letting go a little bit of, like, your power as a clinician, because, like, you want to, like, sit down and do this, like, play therapy, but, like, what if that's, like, not useful for this kid?
Yeah.
So you want to sit down and, like, and do something else, or you want to, like, go outside and do something.
Yeah.
But, like, I feel like if I was working with kids, I would just let it be directed by the kid. I would just kind of follow the kids.
I mean, I think that's fair, but, like, isn't there value in maybe, like, trying another way first and seeing if it doesn't,
that's,
you know,
what I mean.
Work with the kids? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so, like, I would try all these, like, play therapy is what I would do with the kids. Sit down and play games and, like, oh, why did you do that with that move? Or, like, with that card? Or, like, why did you set that card down or whatever?
Just, like, but, I mean, like, what if they can't talk? But that's, like, a huge, like, you know, issue and divide in communication, that, like, they're not going to be able to answer that question for you, you know? And some people have...
I
think that's the problem, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is that there are people that are that kind of, like, sort of, like, bringing yourself... I don't want to say bring yourself down to their level, but, like, putting yourself kind of, like, in their world or whatever, like, is more beneficial, you know? And then, like, for others, it may be not, like, won't be, you know? And I nannied, like, a nonverbal, like, autistic kid for several years now, and, like, some people have, you know, just such strong opinions about, like, you know, what his parents are doing for him, and, like, you know, if they did something differently or took him, like, this place, like, you know, he might be able to talk now, you know? And he actually was, like, speaking in the beginning of his life, so it's, like, really kind of weird, but anyway, that is to say that, like, you know, from their perspective, it'd be such a positive thing if he could speak. So, like, is it warranted to keep trying these things that, like, are going to agitate him if they can lead to, like, a kind of breakthrough moment or whatever? I think the reading talked about how, like, the breakthrough moments are the most heart-rending for, like, autistic families because, you know, they're so disappointing or whatever. But, I don't know.
How is he nonverbal? Like, is there, like, I guess I'm wondering, like,
so he just doesn't, like, use any words. Like, he can say, like, nine now. And he has a brother who is, like, very bright and is younger and everything, so that's, like, even, like, harder. But he just has, like, really, really frustrated easily, and he can say, like, I don't know, like, mimic his sound or whatever, but, like, something along the lines of, like, yeah, but that's all that you can do.
Can he understand, like, when people say, like, sentences?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that it's hard to discern when he's, like...
Yeah, how do you know that he's understanding? I mean, yeah. If you give him a command, he'll follow it.
Exactly, because often his response is this, like, kind of word that's sort of like, yeah, you know what I mean? So you don't know if he's just, like, that's his like, go-to kind of default response, or if he does understand, you know?
Does he communicate that way?
Yeah, well, so that's why I thought that was interesting that girl was talking about how it's sort of ironic that, you know, people find, like, autism so limiting because really they respond, they, like, were limited to, like, vocal communication, I guess.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, some autistic kids, like, use several forms of communication, you know? So, like, he is more, like, physical, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, our world operates around, like, you know, vocal communication, so it is, like, a disadvantage,
right.
I would say.
And that's kind of, like, what I was saying before, like, child with other things that, like, I would do with, like, just clinically because that's what
yeah,
I learned.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
So, yeah, like, that's interesting.
Well, and I think it's a struggle, like, for a family like his as to when to decide, like, the most important thing now is to, like, you know, kind of, like, make him happy, you know, versus, like, when should you keep on that journey towards trying to, like, get him to speak so that he can, you know, operate, quote-unquote, normally in the world, you know what I mean? I don't know, because, you know, you might kind of, like, give up hope, and then all of a sudden somebody comes, like, these encouraging doctors with, like, some kind of, like, new therapy or something, you know?
What about something like that? She wants to get
it, like, in general? I don't know. Yeah, that's a good point.
I guess, like, as an intervention for nonverbal or, like, teaching sign language.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if kids would be receptive to that. Or,
yeah, I don't know either.
I don't know sign language. So, you know,
I don't either.
I wouldn't even know, like, where to begin. Like, on a practical level.
It definitely seems like something that would require a lot of patience, which
yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to make any, like, generalizations, but, like, in terms of, like, autistic kids that I've interacted with, that's not something they're well endowed with, you know?
Yeah.
No, that's a good point, though, for sure.
When you said normal, you made me think of, you know, she was saying it was, like, even though you can't, like, it's not a physical disability, like, they have all their arms and legs and their face looks normal. But I still think, I don't know any autistic children, but I actually met an autistic person.
Oh, cool.
She was at a veterinary office I went to. It was so awesome.
Yeah. Oh,
but you could totally tell her disability.
Oh, when you met her.
Well, the minute she walked in the room, kind of. Well, she dressed funny. Like, she dressed as if,
I didn't see the image.
She was, like, weird and kosher. And when I saw the movie they made about her, I was like, really? Are you going to wear that in public?
Yeah.
But she wants to wear it. Over here's the spot.
Yeah, sure.
No, I was just going to look. She has a presence, like, when she walks in there. Yeah. Yeah. Her clothes, I think.
Huh.
But also when you... when you meet her,
yeah.
She doesn't take your hand.
Huh.
And my friend that was with me wanted me to take
just about four more minutes to wrap it up.
And then
we'll
to, like, lean in together, and she stood, like, this far apart.
Oh.
Didn't smile. So I thought it was interesting because even though how accomplished she is, like, she's a PhD now, she teaches to overcome her autism. She still goes on, like,
normal.
100%
yeah.
Normal.
Taking
huh.
That.
That's so cool that you met her.
Oh, yeah. It's really awesome. I listened to her lecture and I have a book signed by her.
Oh. Wow. What very cool.
She's so intriguing.
Well, so in that sense, like, it's totally debunks what I was saying, and it seems like it's an asset for her.
I think it is, yeah. Even in her book, she's like, I would never change it. I would never wish different.
Yeah.
I think she would be amazing. She's one of those that I've met.
I'm sure.
But she's still...
Well, it kind of makes me think of like the questions like when is like what are the contexts that make being abnormal like it feasible to have that be an asset and when is it not, you know? And I think it depends on what the like oddity or abnormality is and what the like society is or even just like what environment you
or like what the values are.
Yeah.
That
sure.
Oddity or whatever.
Sure.
What my
I'm gonna run to the restroom later. Sorry.
That's right.
No, go ahead.
My favorite part of the article I think was how she said the fragmentation shifted and how it used to be separating family from them and now it separates families. Like
yeah.
Kinda how fragmentation shifted. I guess it's more medical knowledge. I just thought that was part was really interesting.
Yeah, and with like the mirror and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was okay, I'll be back.
Okay.
Well.
In this case, it would be because you can't get your car done in that middle. Let's say.
Way ahead of the job.
I mean,
that is. You know, completely divided. And, like, you still don't even though it's like, you still don't deny it. I mean,
nobody should ask.
But I think, you know, so we still don't have the
person in the family.
It's still seen as either something that's in your past, you know what I mean, or...
I mean, you could say this about, like, Alzheimer's.
This is way.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
People with autism, that's like,
I feel like
it's perceived as not being whole people.
Yeah.
And autism is depicted as a tragedy that will break up families, individual members. And you just kind of probably think, what? You know, like...
And why do we need...
Insert the word art.
So, I guess the question is, why do we need...
Yeah.
Okay, if you think about it,
these types of surgeries.
It kind of happens to them, or like...
Contemporary Times notion of fragments of the family.
All right, so
resulted from.
We have 20 minutes. I heard this at a conference. Clap once if you can hear me. Clap twice if you can hear me. Isn't that awesome? They did that at a conference because nobody would stop talking. I was like, I have to use that. It worked, did it not? Okay. Oh, thank you. Why don't we, and I don't want to necessarily go in any particular order, but I'm just going to look at the right-hand side of the room and think about all the things that you talked about. What do you most want to share that you thought was most pertinent, most relevant to the questions? I can point at you if you'd like, or...
Who wants to start?
Yes. Sylvie, why don't you start?
Since you asked. All right. What I'm going out is like what we discussed.
I'm not sure where to begin, so I guess I'll just start with. Well, I need like an intro because you can talk about yours and I'll talk. I feel like we were like.
All in the place.
We were like, yeah.
Oh.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
She wanted you to go first.
Yeah, I wanted you to start because I like you started and then I started thinking about it. That way.
All right, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Did you find these themes, did you see them as clearly as I did in the piece? Did you look at these and go, crap, I didn't notice any of these themes? Or was it?
No. We kind of got off on a little tangent.
Okay.
About diagnoses and legitimizing
mm-hmm. a child's behavior based on the fact that there was a true diagnosis of autism, and how I think she was saying she felt sometimes autism is being overdiagnosed because there's not a specific test. There's not, you know, like a blood test. So, okay, now you're autistic. So we kind of kept going off on mm-hmm. tangents a little bit like that.
Which is a theme.
Yeah.
Legitimacy. mm-hmm. Bell curve of normal. Where are the lines drawn?
Yeah, and for me, at least, it calls to mind the question of, like, when can, like, an abnormality, like, be an asset, and when can it not? And, like, you know, based on, like, the condition for the person, and based on the context in which the person kind of, like, exists, like, you know, how do we see those, like, differentiate? And you...
I met Temple Grandin at a conference, and she was saying about a boy that she babysat for, and she said something about, you know, different types of treatment that maybe could potentially one day make him normal. And I said, you know, when I met Temple Grandin, as accomplished as she has a PhD, she's a professor, she's done amazing things, and I think, you know, she says her autism is an asset to her. But you can still tell she's not normal, I think, when you talk to her, when you mm-hmm. meet her, when you get asked to get your picture taken with her. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was an interesting. So when and how is it different for...
Yeah, and yet her difference, like, ended up being, at least from her perspective, like a huge asset. Mm-hmm. Or, like, completing her versus... What's the word? Like,
it was, like, not whole or something.
The fragmentation.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, yeah, I guess...
And my favorite part about the whole fragmentation thing is how they say it changed. As autism, I guess, is more, I guess not more popular, but more.
We know what you mean.
Yeah. they used to say autism was a result of a broken family, and now they say autism breaks a family. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was really interesting how that fragmentation mm-hmm. completely changed.
And further, still some people disagree with that.
Right.
A few years ago, we had a student who was working somewhere in the med school on an autism project, and it was, they got boatloads of money to do this multi-pronged, sort of like a Framingham-esque thing with parents with kids with autism to actually, you know, daily document. And they were like, we're just going to cast the net so wide. We're going to look for what kind of shampoo you use, what kind of this you use, what kind of foods you eat, where do you buy your food, you know, to try to see if we can get enough data and plug it into this machine, can we get a better cause for this? I don't know if it ever went anywhere. But I felt a little uncomfortable, but then also, like, wouldn't that be so nice if we just all knew, don't use Aquanet, you know?
I had an interview at Drexel with Craig Neuschafer, who's doing basically just that. He's following, he's recruiting people, women who have a child with autism, and either are pregnant or plan to become pregnant, and they're taking environmental, you know, they're swabbing everything in their house, they're doing interviews, they're going when they give birth, and they're collecting placental samples and breast milk samples and, you know, like, information about the birth, like, literally collecting, you know, soup to nuts information
right.
about, you know, all of it.
What's their end?
To look to see if there's...
No, and, like, how many people are they...
I don't know. I don't know, actually.
But are they also looking at women with children that don't have autism? Because if you don't have anything to compare it mm-hmm. to, you're not going to find mm-hmm. anything.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think so.
Maybe that's a different multi... It's a different center in a multi-center study. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you would... Anyway. But I think these are... And why I like the fact that they were two really distinct topics is because they show how these same trajectories, these same desires, these same relationships are replicated in different settings. Okay, so Let's see what our other autistic group, and you guys can then talk amongst yourselves to us.
As far as things that stood out, I guess, one of the things that I saw from you, I want to speak for everyone else here, was when you were over with us, what constitutes a disorder, and this kind of goes back to, you know, concept of reality, and if it's kind of like disorders in the eye of the beholder, and so what used to be a disability, we use the example of, like, you know, not being able to see, it's not really so much of a disorder anymore. I think Hill was saying, like, what was it? It was like there's three, the disability community has three different. Right. So, like, people are only disabled insofar as they can't, you know, accommodate for that curve. Well, if you can accommodate for autism, you know, via YouTube or something like that, if they're only communicating, then is that a disorder? Like, what is a disorder exactly?
What would you make of the idea that it's not just a matter of accommodation? But it's deeper than that. It goes to the habitus of what we expect.
I think that's a different, like, part of accommodation. Like mental accommodation. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't expect certain things from certain people.
I was thinking more like Down syndrome. There's one of the strategies now for parents who prenatally test very high likelihood that their child will be born with Down syndrome. Certain parts of the country and certain practices will facilitate those parents meeting other parents of kids with Down syndrome. The idea being, you know, you've got this Down syndrome body as spectacle, you know, that is also reflected in the fact that up until a few years ago, kids born with severe Down syndrome, you know, their lives were not made easy from the minute of birth based on how CHOP was, how you know, HUP was organized, based on for sort of labor and delivery.
So, like, the community of people with Down syndrome, being Down syndrome, having Down syndrome isn't so aberrant, kind of deal, or? I mean, there's the community of little people that they talked about in one of the different articles. I mean, this
infighting amongst them as well.
What's that?
Infighting.
Right. Which is, I guess, existing with people who don't, you know, who aren't little people, you know. So let's go on the same lines.
When she talks about the concept of reality, the definition of reality, she says in the article that there are different parts of the world, such as for the mass media and narratives of people with autism. And the reality reveals itself not in the convergence of those voices, but in them being big clash. Mm-hmm. Which I think it's, I definitely think it's true, but I wanted to critique a bit. She mentions this critique somewhat, but she doesn't, I don't think she talks about it enough. And the critique is that these narratives of people with autism, like Dr. Dugin, and these are very accomplished people who are able to use autism to their autism attributes to their benefit. But in the disability community, there's this notion of the superhero disabled.
A what? Superhero disabled? Is that what you said?
Yeah, or? Like the super, super disabled person.
Okay.
Despite their disability, despite their impairment, they were able to be the PhD, MD, the astronaut, whatever, beyond the layperson, with or without disability. And she mentions this critique that the narratives that we hear from people without disability is from people who are immune to that. Mm-hmm. People who are very accomplished. Or able to communicate despite their autism, but they are very accomplishing or successful in communicating their own experiences. But autism is a spectrum. And that voice is not heard in this this article. And another way to look about to look at another example that maybe can shed some light on what I'm trying to say, I hope, is the it's a struggle around the DSM-5, the new the fifth edition of the DSM-5 of the American Psychiatric Association, and the definition of Asperger, which is a form of autism, but it's definitely considered, I think, as the better form of autism because these are people who are very high functioning, usually with really above average intelligence. Many times people would say that Bill Gates, for example, has Asperger, and so on and so forth. So the DSM-5 wanted to dismiss the definition of Asperger and put people with Aspies, as they define themselves, Aspies as part of the autism spectrum. But that's a change of, entire change of identity and community, and not for the better of that specific group of autism. And I think it shows that A, autism is a spectrum, and B, that there's also a hierarchy within the autism spectrum, and definitely hierarchy in the sense of what values we attribute as a society to different kinds of different places in that spectrum. It also, I think, shows to the criticism that some people with autism can definitely communicate, but some people cannot. Mm-hmm. And we again put value to people who are above and beyond the layperson, with or without autism, like Temple Grandin, that can talk to animals. But who with autism, without autism, like, most people cannot do that. So it's a criticism that I think he doesn't give enough room.
She seems to give it lip service every once in a while, but then says it needs to be further discussed. All right, cool. I mean, I'm perfectly happy. I mean, there is no answer. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm just being like, okay, done. But I mean, the point is not to answer it.
You said something about the spectrum, and like that's why I kind of go back and forth about this disorder, like what constitutes a disorder. A spectrum of what is, I guess, what a spectrum of better or worse, like severe, less severe, more disabled, less disabled. I mean, it would seem like that's the obvious answer, correct? I mean, somebody who is fully, I mean, I'm looking for this help directing at you. But
she is our resident disability scholar.
And I will.
She's credentialed, she's card carrying.
But I mean, it seems like, I keep going back to this, like, at some point, you know, like I was saying earlier, you know, legs are made for walking, you know, kind of thing. Like, do we not have to delineate at some point? Like, this is not, dare I say, natural, you know? And I always say that.
Define your axes.
Right, that's exactly what I'm asking. I mean, I said the opposite when I started off, so I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to.
And I think, you know, what I think of as a spectrum is at some point you pass from, like, there's a line. And if everything's a spectrum, then you have, you know, the most severely disabled person with autism. And, you know, the most normal person. But, like, somewhere in there you cross over into, you know, where you're on this side of the line, you're quirky but normal, and then you're on the side of the line and suddenly you're diagnosable, you know, and that it isn't really linear, and, you know, if...
Then it seems actually even more arbitrary if that's the case.
But it relates to the social...
Right.
It relates to the social body that is... that slide three, where we had the socially constructed individual bodies and the social institutional body that
helps to construct those bodies.
Right. So insofar as they're capable or incapable of, let's say,
there's no absolute scale.
Right, right, of expressing themselves or whatever.
discounting the extremes.
Right,
you
right.
have to always sort of.
So it's kind of like temporal. Like it depends. You know, it's disabled in 2012. You know, as opposed to what it would be in, you know, 1912 or 2000.
Or imagine when we do have those, you know, holographic projection screens embedded in our heads. You know, or, you know, just doing those. This will come true. You mark my words. You know, the fact that they're doing with people who previously thought to be in absolute permanent vegetative state, who are somewhat communicating. So yes, right now it does seem, and that's why you have to go to science fiction, because if you don't, of course you can't imagine what else it would be. So.
But I do want to say that I think a few things. First of all, I think it's a spectrum because we don't really have a line that where we can say this is autism type A, this is autism type B, and so on and so forth, except maybe Asperger, which is has more typical characteristics. So I think it's a spectrum because A, we don't really understand the what you call it disorder, but I don't think we really understand what autism is. We can't really put every person on a specific point on the spectrum, but there are differences within functioning, and I think
relative to. That's I think the sentence fragment that has to be added to that, which because otherwise we're going to go right back to Jeff's point of how do we label this? So yes, there are differences in what was the word you used?
Function. So, if I can use maybe to use a metaphor in order to step aside for example from the contentious autism question, for people who use wheelchairs, who cannot walk and have to use wheelchairs in order to be mobile, there is the physical impairment state of not being able to use legs. But there is the social aspect, the social aspect of that impairment, which is the disability. Some people will define, which is the disability. If our world would have been accessible, there's no disability.
Because legs and wheels both are just equal moving around devices.
Exactly. But there is still, I think there is still room within our culture to. There is a need to give place to the physical experience of not being able to walk. So there are some extreme theories on the disability community where it's not the impairment, it's always the disability. But I think a more progress theory is the one that also accepts the physical our experience in the world.
Phenomenological, yeah. You know, I'm going to send, and I do, if everyone can, like, if you have to leave, sure, but if you can stay for an extra 5 minutes, because I do want to hear what you guys said about this. I need to remember, and I'll do it next week, there's a book called Stumbling Into Happiness. It has one of the chapters is the most wonderful story of, and it goes back to Siamese twins, but I think the point relates, to say, we non-Siamese twins, think we know what happiness is. And we feel it. It's embodied. It's all of those things, you know, the awareness of what it's like to move around on legs. We can't understand how someone conjoined could be happy. I mean, we could maybe think, but on the, you know, really, no. You know, come on. This sort of how they lead you into this. And by the time you get to the end of the article, damn it, if you don't want to be a conjoined twin. You know, because they do, you know, they do such a good job of showing the contextual, embodied, phenomenological nature of our worldview. So yes, we do have to give some attention to the embodiment of not being able to move around on your legs. But again, it goes back to the social personal body.